Session number 27075, Reel 24.
Squadron Leader Leggett, Reel 24.
His life in the desert, really, it was quite good. I think largely because living was pretty basic. We didn't have any fancy goods at all. We had our rather dusty desert clothing. We all wore these brothel creepers, as they were called, suede shoes with thick soles, or booties. And most of us wore shorts. Some elected to wear slacks. Most of us wore shorts. I used to wear a bush shirt most of the time. Just an ordinary cap. Some people again, some people wore forage caps. I wore an ordinary uniform cap. Again, of course, because our routine was rather different to those of the majority of the Western Desert Air Force. There were only—I think we were the only night squadron in the whole of the Western Desert Air Force. When I say night fighters, and we, after our night's operation, would have some food and go to bed for the morning, and we'd usually get up about midday. And there was always something going on. Formations of bombers, Baltimores, Mitchells, Baltimores, Marauders, and one other, I can't remember Boston's. The name. Boston, that's the one, yeah. There'd be formations of those coming and going non-stop, with or without escorts, mostly of Kitty Hawks, sometimes Spitfires. And that would be going on pretty well all day. At intervals, they'd come over and come and go, come and go. On the whole, they seem to be getting away with it. They're flying formations of 12 or 15. Sometimes there'd be the odd one or two missing, but on the whole, they came back intact time and time again. So they're obviously having quite a good war. And we who were not on duty officially during the daytime could witness all this going on either from outside the tent or down on the beach.
Was that a heartening sight to see most of the aircraft returning without very, very few casualties?
It was heartening, though. We did tend to take it very much for granted that this is the way things were, and these chaps were going to keep this up. Yeah, but yes, it was good to know, and it was also good to know that we were relatively secure during my whole time in the desert, and only once whilst I was there, only once. Where we attacked, strafed on the ground. As I mentioned, that was at Wadi Temat when the Italians knocked out a couple of our aircraft. So, because we were not subject to regular attack on the ground, we felt safe and secure. In fact, we really didn't give very much thought to the possibility of being attacked by enemy aircraft.
Were your landing grounds defended at all?
Yes, I think they were. I think there was generally a Bofors hovering somewhere round about. But I think that's all there was. There might have been, there might possibly have been some machine guns, but I think it was down to this Bofors more often than not. Surprisingly, we didn't see very much of the army. I suppose being 10 miles back, as we usually were, it's not surprising we didn't see a lot of the army, who would be that much further forward. Occasionally, a few tanks would come rumbling over the horizon, but they were usually just a reconnaissance party. They didn't appear to be doing anything in particular. They just rumbled around and went round the side of the airfield. Sometimes some of the troops would go and have a natter with them. And then one day, there was a roar in the sky. We looked up. Now, this was, when I say one day, this would have been this would have been in the spring, 43. And there was this roar in the sky, and we looked up. Yes, it had been, as I say, about, probably about January 43. And there was a formation of American Mitchells going over the top. And they're in a tight formation. They went over and then started thinning themselves out and moved round to a downwind position and came in and landed one after the other. So it was all very exciting. Hadn't even heard they were coming. And they landed and they all taxied over to the other side of the airfield. I said, I'm calling these airfields, really they're nothing more than a stretch of desert. Sometimes the army had been in and done a bit of levelling. But very often there wasn't much work to be done. And usually the limits were marked by white oil drums, large oil drums, painted white, and we stick those on the corners of the landing strips. And so these chaps landed, tacked it off to the other side of the strip, and switched themselves off. And at the same time, perfect timing, this whole great convoy of American trucks came rumbling across. And they all moved in on the far side, and up went their tents. They got caravans and tents and caravans. And in no time at all, they got themselves organized. And so we went over, made ourselves known, and suggested they might like to come over for some refreshment that night, which they gladly accepted. And about 8 o'clock, there was this racket outside, and all these jeeps started coming across. And in no time at all, we got the entire American Air Force. Fortunately, we had some wine, as you know, and they started drinking it. Well, you never saw anything like it. They were dry. They started lashing into this Chianti. Well, in no time at all, the whole place is an uproar. It's a wonder that the Germans didn't strike at that moment. They met no opposition whatever. And this party went on, oh, God knows. Let it not be said that it was only the Americans who were doing the boozing. It was a free-for-all. And when things were just beginning to get a little bit out of hand, the colonel said, "Are you guys, we're getting back home now, mount your trucks." And they all started piling onto their trucks and falling over each other and giggling and laughing. It really was very amusing. They climbed on their trucks and set off across the airfield. And they, most of them were wearing guns. And they started pulling out these guns and shooting into the air, bang, bang, Wild West stuff. Across the airfield, on the other side, were their aircraft parked, and they had guards mounted around the aircraft who observed this activity from the enemy, all these guns being fired off, so they started firing back. Well, fortunately, none of them were very good shots. I think a few windscreens got shattered. But nothing very serious, which is incredible. And that was the last time they came. I think they did invite the one or two senior officers, I think, but for the rest of us, that was one good party.
As you moved up from Egypt through to Tunisia, you've mentioned a little bit about how you made the moves. What were the towns like en route? Because you mentioned you visited Benghazi and Tripoli. What did they look like after 3 years of war?
Fairly intact. I didn't go into Tobruk, which was pretty well levelled, I believe. Benghazi dockyard was devastated. There were blown up ships everywhere, and ships literally had been blown out of the water, lying all over the place. Quite incredible. Yes, the Benghazi harbour, which is a big harbour, had been blasted well and truly, and peripheral buildings and so on happened to get in the way, and they'd be blown up as well. But the town as a whole, the centre part of the town, was minimal damage. There might be the odd building here or there down, but not very much at all. I think I'm right in saying that the city wasn't actually fought over. I think it was always a case of bypassing. Any sort of habitation was usually bypassed. I think Benghazi was in that category. And again, Tripoli was much the same. There wasn't a lot of damage in Tripoli, except again around the dock area and Castel Bonito airfield, of course, that had taken a fair pounding.
What was Castel Bonito like? Because you visited that, didn't you?
Well, we were operating from there, yes. We moved up to Castel B. And it was quite pleasant. It was green. It's most of the desert we'd been in was all sand and grit. But Castel Bonito was on the edge of an agricultural area. Mostly citrus fruits. But it was green. There was a bit of grass about, which was quite pleasant. We put our tents in nice grassy, leafy spots. And that was quite nice. And once or twice we went into Tripoli, but apart from wandering round and just having a look-see, there wasn't an awful lot doing, because nothing had really been opened up. There was one establishment, a hotel of sorts, where the restaurant was open, or of sorts, but it was absolutely packed. Everybody was trying to get some food, and let it be said, the staff were doing their best to cope with this flood of people. And after, I think, a wait of a couple of hours, I think they did manage to come up with some lamb chops or something. The booze had run out, and I think we're drinking grenadine, if you can imagine it. So yes, it was interesting, but it was going to obviously take some little while for the place to be reorganised. I expect, in fact, I dare say the utilities were in a bit of a shambles. And they had to be all sorted before the town could really be said to be back on its feet.
Did you have a chance to look at any wrecked Axis aircraft?
Oh, yes. Airfield? Yes, indeed. Just trying to remember where the picture is. I've got a picture somewhere of wrecked German aircraft.
Would that be the first chance that you'd actually had to look at them close up, really, apart from in the air?
Yes. Yes, I think the first. I think the first German aircraft I saw would have been in the Benghazi area. Yes. Yes, because you see, they didn't use any airfields beyond Alamein. I think Fuka, which is probably about 20 miles back, two or three airfields at Fuka, they were there. And then all the way back, there'd be X-axis aircraft. And I think it was not until Benghazi, or Benina to be precise, that there were quite a lot of wrecked aircraft. 109s, 52s, I think that's what they were mostly. Yes, there were one or two Mackies. Castel Bonito, there were several Mackies, 202s and 200s. One or two big Savoia Marchetti troop carriers. And then at in Tunis, just outside Tunis itself, our little airfield there, in the surrounding fields, there were a lot of German aircraft. I'm not quite sure what they were doing there. They were mostly wheels up, belly flop landings. There was the first 190 I saw was there. Several 109s. And out on the beach, there were quite a lot of Italian transport. Again, I think they must have, for some reason, tried to land these things on the beach. So, yes, it was interesting. And I used to amuse myself taking odd bits off. I had a beautiful tail fin from a 109, had the whole fin, with a big swastika on it. And I proudly lugged that all the way back and propped it up outside my tent. A certain amount of souvenir hunting used to go on, because the army always got in first. When an enemy aircraft crashed, they were on the scene in a matter of seconds, stripping all the instruments out. They used to look, the clock was always the first thing to go, followed by the rest of the instruments and anything else anybody thought was an interesting souvenir. But yes, they were interesting times.
Was there any increase in aerial activities you got towards Tunisia at all at night, or was it still as quiet as it had remained?
Much the same applied, unfortunately. I at El Hamma, was it? I think El Hamma. El Hamma was interesting. I don't know why this was. Oh, yes, we must have been moving up, I think. Yes, that's right, we were moving up to El Hamma from the Baraf line. And we were flying in squadron formation, and there was the airfield ahead, and I suddenly sort of woof, great woof, and another woof on the airfield, and I thought, oh, it looks like the bomb disposal boys are there or blowing up mines or something, and then more woofs, And we got to the airfield and went into our usual landing pattern, landed one after the other, taxied in, looking round for somebody to tell us where to go, and a soul in sight. And there's more whoops. And we all taxied across to what appeared to be a vacant part of the airfield. There were various aircraft dotted about. And we were just about to switch off. And suddenly a staff car appeared. Desert painted staff car. Came tearing across the airfield. Came up towards us. Door flew open, a chap jumped out and said, get off, we're under shell fire. And all of a sudden there was whoomph, more whoomps. And yeah, the airfield had been bombarded. Well, you never saw such a fast scramble in all your life. that was a record one. The whole squadron was airborne in a matter of seconds. And this whoomping kept on going. And yeah, fortunately nothing was hit, but it was entertaining, to say the least of it. And yes, that's El Hammer.
Operating the Hurricane in the desert, were there any particular problems of operating in such a sandy terrain with the aircraft?
Standard
terrain? In the sandy terrain.
Oh, I see. No. It would be if you're in an area where you did get real Sahara, Hollywood Sahara desert sand. But this was unusual. Most of the desert is fairly flat. And it's gravelly. It is sandy, but it's gravelly sand. And the surface would have been gone over by the advanced people before we were given clearance to move up. Somebody would have been either from the group headquarters or maybe the army would have done it, they would go and have a look at the airfield, particularly of course from the point of view of unexploded bombs or mines. They'd go and see it. And if there's any question about the surface, they would have held us off until we were satisfied it was suitable for landing on and carrying on operations. Who actually did the inspection, I must confess, I don't know, because our job was simply to get in the thing and fly up to it when it was declared to be okay. What we did have to be very careful about everywhere, of course, was landmines. And the only thing you could do wisely was always to walk in the tracks, fresh tracks of a vehicle. If you walked across open desert, you took your life in your hands, because you didn't know what to look for. The bomb disposal boys, that they knew what to look for, and even they could come unstuck at times. But I don't recall having any problem. I think possibly yes, in the back of my mind, there is one airfield that was a little bit questionable, and one was a bit on the short side when we had our Spitfires in Tunisia. One was a bit on the short side. You had to get it down very early on the beginning of the strip, otherwise you'd overshoot. But no, we seem to get away with it most of the time.
I was thinking as well, would that kind of environment, though, would it affect the Hurricane's engine or working parts at all?
Well, yes, I'm sure it did. And it was quite horrific. to see the troops working on the aircraft. Yes, with they'd very often be stripping engines down and doing all sorts of things. And how all these bits and pieces were exposed to the dust and sand, I really don't know. But I can't recall, in the whole year I was with that squadron, I can't recall a single known engine failure. Now, it's possible there had been the other side of the lines and we never got to know about it. No, it's a remarkable fact. Somehow they managed to keep things going. Mind you, the Hurricane was a pretty rugged aeroplane. There's nothing fancy about it. And it's quite clear in the present Gulf campaigns, where we have these highly sophisticated machines, I can't imagine that any open air servicing could be carried out on them. I mean, even the tanks, as we know, we hear that even the tanks got stuck in the sand in the Gulf. There again, I'd be most surprised to hear that the 8th Army tanks got stuck in the sand, stuck in the sand, but contaminated by dust, which is apparently what's been happening in the Gulf.
The Hurricanes you were operating with, you operated with cannon.
Is there
anything that's different about operating with cannon than you've explained to me before about operating with machine guns?
Yes. Well, there are two things, of course. One is the fact that the cannon has considerably more range than the 303 machine guns. Secondly, the hitting power of even two cannon is considerably better than the machine guns. And of course, the 420mm cannon is a devastating gun platform. If you got in close on any enemy aircraft, got in really close and blasted them with 420mm, it was certainly a destroyed aircraft, no doubt about that. And even two cannon could do a lot of damage. So, although it's always advisable to get in close with the cannon, you had got that little bit of extra range. And if you got into a good firing position, you stood a reasonably good chance of getting some good hits on the aircraft. The only noticeable thing about the cannon, firing the four cannon, was there was quite a sharp nose-down tendency as the cannons fired. And they momentarily slowed down the aircraft. The back pressure was quite considerable, and it was enough to give the aircraft quite a little bit of a jolt when they fired. We didn't have the big 40mm guns that 6th Squadron had. These were the tank buster boys. And they had a 40mm gun under each wing. And I think they did achieve considerable success, I believe, pooping at tanks with these big guns. But for my money, I think the 20mm, particularly if you've got four of them, this is really good. Good solid armament, and you can do quite a lot of damage with them.
What type of cannon shell would they fire?
Be a mixture, ball, expendry, incendiary, or explosive. I think ours were fairly evenly mixed, as far as I know. Yeah. So to, I would imagine that really ball probably did as much damage, if not more, than the other types. It really is a nasty hunk of metal that comes at you, and it can rip things apart. Incendiary, of course, if you can get an incendiary into a fuel tank, although of course that's curtains for that aircraft. And the